Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens, at the heart of Irish homes for over 40 years. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
And it is time now for Callan's Kicks.
All right, settle down. Welcome to the Michael Ring press conference sponsored by my favourite website, rip.ie. Tis like done deal for TDs. Yahoo! Now, I'm launching a crusade here today on all things nonsense, lefty and walkie walk. Question.
Deputy Ring, did you not retire?
That is a scurrilous rumour spread by the Walker Atty. I have been merely lying dormant here for a couple of years, and now
You've woken up?
I'm not woke! You're woke! That question is woke! You and the media better watch yourselves, you're all at it.
Sorry, where's the toilet?
I'm glad you asked that.
Sorry?
Fine Gael needs a return to core values and listen to small, medium and obese farmers instead of all this far lefty, bleeding hearts guff about late night licensing laws.
Sorry, what's woke about nightclubs being open till 6?
There's nothing more woke than staying up all night dancing and jitterbugging and discussing Sally Rooney communism and filthy lit.
Sorry, she's from Mayo. Yeah.
Lies! If she was, she was destroyed by the Trinity College Walker Cola Brigade. That's what they do to people there. And the hate speech law. I hate that. Put me in prison if you want to. That's pure walkie and the bandit, that stuff. We should be able to blackguard, sneer, carp and slag anyone, no matter if they're cross-eyed or riddled with bunions, without the language Bangardee showing up to lock us up because...
You can't say Bangardee anymore.
I'll say what I like. Nah. This is a do-or-die principle for our party. I'd sooner die than support...
You already voted for the hate speech bill.
No. You might be confusing me with Willie O'Dea. We are not the same person. We're just both heavily accented fellas who've been hibernating for years and have now...
Woke up.
We have unasleeped. Even the term woke is woke. Come back now, the whole lot of you.
And Michael Ring will say what he likes. You can hear the full Callan's Kicks this evening, 6:30, right after drive time here on RT Radio 1 or on the RT Radio app. Coming up next, it's The Gathering.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
And it's time now for our Friday gathering. And this week I'm joined by Fianna Fáil TD for Dublin Bay South, party spokesperson on justice, Jim O'Callaghan, features editor at the Irish Times, Mary Minahan, and political editor with the Irish Independent, Philip Ryan. And we're hoping that Louise O'Reilly from Sinn Féin will be here very shortly. Now, let's start with this EU migration pact, because we've been talking about it on the show this week. The government, we were told on cabinet meeting day, has opted into it. We don't know the full details, though, Jim. One element, though, that's clear is this solidarity mechanism that will be in there. This is to support countries like Greece and Italy. So we either take a fair share of their migrants or we pay substantial money to those states instead. That's how it will work. Do you think that's a good idea for Ireland?
That's one aspect of it, Claire, but I think we need to let the people know what's within this migration pact. Like, as a pact, the whole purpose of it is to try to implement a stricter regime in respect of migration. I think that's the political consensus in Europe now. Over 1 million people applied for international protection in the EU last year. We see in Ireland it's going to be probably get to 20,000 this year in terms of the numbers. So the purpose of the pact is to do a variety of things. One of the things is what you said, but it also is going to introduce a situation where you can't, as is happening in Ireland at present, apply for international protection in one EU country and then go elsewhere to another one. It's also going to create a central database which will ensure there's greater control over who's applying for international protection, and also it'll do something that I've been calling on, that we'll have a European Union list to save countries. We'll still be able to add to it, but that'll have the effect of speeding up the process, and it'll make it a stricter process as well. In respect to the Solidarity Pact, what you say about, like, there probably is a benefit, I would have thought, if a country like Ireland could make a financial contribution as opposed to taking in numbers that we can't deal with. But I think we need to recognise that there has to be a stricter regime, there has to be a stricter approach. And if we don't opt into this, we're going to do what the UK did. And we saw with the UK that when they went out on their own, the numbers coming in seeking asylum increased significantly. So I know, like, Louise and Sinn Féin are saying that we should opt out of it, but they really need to say what's their alternative plan, because if they opt out of it, what we're going to have is the International Protection Act remaining in place. And that clearly is creating problems at present.
Well, Sinn Féin are saying that we shouldn't opt into all of it, but there are certain points in the pact that they do agree with. And I'm sure Louise will tell us that when she's here with us in the studio. Our big problem, Philip, in the immediate term is accommodation. And this pact isn't going to solve that for us.
Well, this is the thing. And we always talk about the immigration crisis, but it's really... It comes from the accommodation crisis. If there was plenty of housing and people were coming here, like the reality is we do need immigration into the country. We need people to come here and work. We need people to work on our building sites, in our restaurants, everywhere, in our hospitals, wherever they can work. We are at full employment. There is plenty of jobs out here. You can see it all the time. So immigration is needed. You need when people come over. It benefits nobody. Someone's leaving some tyrannous regime in North Africa or wherever, and they're coming here looking for a better life, and they end up sleeping in a tent in the city centre. Like that doesn't benefit anybody. You want those people coming here, going into an accommodation, and then being able to get on with life and contribute to society. And that's just not happening at the moment. And that's why, with the pact, that if you can, like Jim says, contribute, and for the time being anyway, before we can try get the accommodation to where we need it to be. And of course, with accommodation, we need someone to build it. So like I said, we need them coming in. So if we can contribute in financially rather than taking people on physically in that time, I think that could be a benefit. Okay. I think it's probably a good idea.
Do you think, Mary, that what we're seeing here is a hardening of attitudes to migration in general?
Yeah, I mean, I think all politicians know that there are rising tensions about immigration in many constituencies. And like, it's important to say that Ireland's not on its own here. Like many states are experiencing local tensions as they struggle to accommodate these rising numbers of people seeking help. So there's plenty of EU governments that are under political pressure on the migration issue. And they do need to be seen, I suppose, to be taken action. And the thing about migration is that, I suppose, future migration trends are very difficult to predict because of unforeseen events. So what Helen McEntee has been saying recently is that there are significant numbers of people on the move due to war, due to conflict, due to starvation brought about by climate change even. So what she is saying this pact will mean is quicker decisions on international protection applications and appeals, and greater focus on efficient returns for unsuccessful applicants. And you can understand why there is a political focus on that. My colleague Sarka Pollock has been writing extensively and intelligently on this recently, and she has also pulled in the idea of Roderick O'Gorman's accommodation strategy, and she's described that as comprehensive and ambitious and wide-ranging. And then combined with McEntee's announcement, it seems the government has finally agreed on a coherent response to the rising numbers of people seeking asylum in this country. But of course, this pact doesn't come into effect until 2026, and department officials are saying that they can't suddenly produce housing for people who are currently living in tents.
And that is the huge issue, as Philip was saying. Louise O'Reilly is here now. You're very welcome, Louise. Thanks for being with us this morning. We're talking about the EU migration pact. There are some issues in there that Sinn Féin don't agree with and do not think that we should sign up to. What specifically?
Well, I think when we look at the issue of migration, we need to look at focusing on a system that is fair, that is enforced. And we don't have that at the moment. We have absolute chaos at the moment. And the minister has said, you know, signing up to aspects of this will mean that, you know, applications are processed faster. Like, that could be done now. There's, you know, there's no need to wait. And there's certainly no need to put this off for 2 years. You know, I mean, like, at the end of the day, the system that is in place is utterly chaotic at the moment. Yeah,
there is something in that, Jim. I mean, a lot of what we're talking about here, the safe country list, the processing of applications, the deportation of people who aren't successful, a lot of these things, they could be done now. And, you know, we are told that the system is improving, but really it's down to this government to use the tools that it has at hand right now to solve the problem in the way that they can.
Yeah, the processing has speeded up. In fairness, that has happened. In terms of safe countries, we've added two countries, Algeria, Botswana, to the list of safe countries. I'd like to see more countries added. But like, I think we need to be realistic as well and face up to the numbers. Like, everyone is humane and compassionate towards people who are seeking international protection. But if you look at the situation even on Mount Street at present, I think it's an inevitable consequence of the numbers. Like, prior to up to 2019, we had 4,700 people applying for international protection. Last year, 2023, we had 13,500. Already in the first 3 months of this year, we have 5,000. So we're heading towards 20,000. And like, fortunately, some of the Ukrainian accommodation is coming free. But like, it is, we're going to inevitably have this problem problem of providing accommodation unless we try to introduce measures as well that will compassionately reduce the numbers of people who are coming to Ireland and applying for international mm-hmm. protection. And that's something I think we have to look
okay.
at.
Let's move on to issues that are affecting transport and climate change. Congestion charges mooted during the week in this suite of measures now that the government says will be given to the local authorities. They'll be able to decide what they're going to do, Philip. Isn't that right? And congestion charges on the cards there. Interesting that Pascal Donoghue, when he was here yesterday, said not in favour of that until we have the infrastructure in place, the public transport infrastructure.
Yeah, look, the congestion charges is something that you see in a lot of European cities. There's an example in the report that Eamon Ryan published this month that showed that there was a huge drop in levels of emissions within London City when they were introduced a long time ago, mm-hmm. and they've been there since. There's also kind of the rural versus urban conversation and debate that you always get around these things, and if you congestion charges, you would have to say, are kind of more balanced in that regard. If you're living in rural parts of the country, you're going to need your car to go drop your kids to school, drop them at practices, go to the shops, where that doesn't really apply as much in a city mm-hmm. or even in the suburbs beyond. So look, it does seem a fair measure, I think, in the reality of what we're trying to deal with. The other interesting one in that report, I thought, was around insurance, that the government
you pay less if you use your car less.
The government wants to work with the insurance industry to introduce some form.
I'm
not sure how it will work. But there is talk, like, if you carpool even, that you would get a reduced rate.
Yeah.
Or you could introduce carpool lanes like they do in some cities as well.
Jim, congestion charge, what do you think?
Bad idea. Don't think we should implement it. I think, you know, it's not a good idea, particularly for Dublin. I'm a TD for the constituency that includes the south inner city. Like, Dublin has gone through a difficult time over the past number of years, and we need to really make sure it has a good summer. I was around Dublin yesterday, around Drury Street. There was a great atmosphere there. And obviously that part has been pedestrianised. But I think putting further charges on top of people who are coming into the city now is not a good idea. Obviously,
but it would make life a lot better for your constituents, would it not?
Well, it'll make it better for some of them. But I think when we're dealing with measures to try to reduce emissions, we are better off trying to deal by bringing people along with us. Like, the public transport in terms of the bus system in Dublin has improved significantly. Cycling infrastructure is there. So people are beginning to see the benefits of coming into the city without their car. And I think we should encourage that rather than sort of, you know, being doctrinaire and saying to them, if you're coming in, you're going to be charged. Inevitably, the people who have more money are going to be able to cope with that. It's the poor people who won't be able to deal with congestion charges such as that. So I think it's a bad idea for the moment. There are some measures in the proposal that were put forward yesterday I think are good ideas. But listen, we need to make sure Dublin has a great summer because it's gone through a difficult time. And I think putting in congestion charges now isn't a good idea.
Louise?
Well, of course, it's the government, and you'd never think it there listening to Jim. It's the government's suggestion. This didn't come out of nowhere, certainly didn't come from the opposition. Jim's own government are bringing forward proposals in relation to congestion charges. And I think, you know, there are people. Decarbonisation is incredibly important. Getting people out of their cars, incredibly important. But you can't punish people for the government's failure to provide public transport. In my experience, and certainly with my constituents, where they can, they will take public transport. They'll take the train, they'll take the bus. But I have more people on to me every single day of the week telling me that they stand at the bus stop and the bus doesn't turn up. We raised this issue with Eamon Ryan. His response was to renew the contract with Go Ahead. They do not provide a good service. Well, certainly not in North County Dublin. And I have people in my constituency who are on a final written warning simply because they're always late.
Well, it's
always
not just late. That company now where you will experience the ghost buses.
No, no,
because
absolutely
I've experienced
not.
Them but myself, but I know
yes.
nothing about
no,
Go
no,
Ahead.
And it is absolutely, and it is, and it's, you know, it has been brought to the attention of the Minister for Transport by me, certainly. I know by our spokesperson, Darren O'Rourke, and Martin Kenny on I don't know how many occasions.
But on the principle of the congestion charge, are you saying then, Sinn Féin, not in favour of
that's
this,
not
even
fair.
Though it would make for a better life for people who are living and working within the city?
What it would do essentially is punish people who don't have an alternative, who can't use public transport and have no alternative but to take their car. And there are plenty of those people. We need to focus on ensuring that people have access to public transport. That's the best mm-hmm. way to make the city more livable. And I agree with Jim. Dublin needs to have a good summer.
Is anyone, Mary, are you in favour of a congestion charge?
Well, I think what this is kind of a hit 'em where it hurts strategy, but it does contain some incentives as well for people to change their behaviour. I think, like, the reality is you won't be able to address climate change without these kind of measures. And also inevitable is that there will be a political backlash. I mean, you know, this is a huge story. It was on the front page of the Irish Times yesterday, and my colleague Kevin O'Sullivan described it as a radical plan. And that's, it is radical. Like this, it's a strategy that that aims to reverse the car-centric model. It's dominated our lives for decades. And, you know, RT, far be it from me to stick my nose into RT's business, but it does have a fantastic programme later in the day called Drive Time. Why is it called Drive Time? Mm. Lots of people listening aren't driving. I hold my hands up. I drove here today because I was worried that the bus wouldn't be on time. I'm sure it would be fine, but
isn't that the whole point, though? We do have drive time, you know, at least twice a day in this country. That's what we do. The Irish Times has a motoring supplement because people buy cars still, because we have to. There's no other way to get around. So is it appropriate to put the stick in place when we still have to get into our cars to go most places?
Well, I think the strategy does recognise that the car will remain the main mode of transport for many, particularly in rural areas, and it will be needed by people that just can't access cars for various reasons. But I am conscious, you know, that we're speaking here in Dublin, where we have access to many forms of public transport. I always say, you know, there's no Dart in Donegal, there's no Lewis in Letterfrack. We're living in luxury compared to many people in rural Ireland.
And there won't be a metro in your constituency, Jim, if you have your way.
That's incorrect, Claire, because it'll go to Stephen's Green, which is in my constituency. I want to see the metro built. And in fairness to Ambora Planola and the inspector, they just concluded 6 weeks of hearing yesterday. It's been a very democratic process, very efficient process. Everyone had their say. I said I want the board to recommend that permission be granted. I said it should be subject to a condition. I don't think it's a good idea to terminate the metro in Charlemont, which is beyond the two canals. The reason I said that is because I want to have a vision for Dublin. I want to be able to see Dublin in 30, 40 years, that we'll have the metro going out to the southwest of the city. I'm probably one of the luckiest TDs in the country. I've got the Lewis on the eastern side of my, or the western side of my constituency. I have the Dart on the eastern side. So I've two rail links there. And we need to look at places where we have the rail link linking up with Stephen's Green to places like Harold's Cross, Terenure, Walkinstown, Knockline. A group called Metro Southwest made a very effective submission before the oral hearing. And I think they got a lot of support and respect of it. And I think it's something we need to look at.
Is he a NIMBY?
It's an interesting approach to politics, though.
Not listening to this now. You know, I have all the trains and all the buses and all the rest of it. They're waiting 26 years on their metro, and I can tell you, there are people in my constituency who bought their homes more than 20 years ago from brochures, bought them off the plans, from brochures that showed the metro going past the front of their homes. OK, so you can imagine how those people will feel listening to Jim showing off there about all the darts
I'm
and everything else that
metro,
he has. What we need is we need a metro link that goes to Dublin Airport and also links in Swords. If you talk to people working in the airport, they will tell you that at least 10 times a day they're stopped by passengers arriving from other countries who will say to them, where do I get the train?
But Jim is in favour of that. He just doesn't want to go.
I'm just suggesting that it should terminate in the city centre.
I'm in favour of
Dublin based out have too much public transport.
Too much public transport.
Their air is too clean and needs much more carbon emissions within it as possible.
I'm trying to think of a vision for metro.
It's an interesting strategy, Jim.
Southwest of the city is the one part of the city that doesn't have any rail infrastructure. It should have it. And there's no reason why this shouldn't terminate in Stephen's Green. So we have the option in the future going southwest. If it terminates in Charlemont, the only thing that will happen in the future is that the Green Line will be redeveloped.
But again, these are proposals that are coming from government. And, you know, but it's supported by government. And I think, you know, the fundamental point here is we have an airport that does not have a rail link.
And it needs
that
to
is absolutely
it's a national
ridiculous.
Embarrassment, that is.
Well,
any
it
other,
needs to happen. Of course it needs to happen.
Any advanced country in Europe or elsewhere, you can get off an airport and walk 5-10 minutes to a train station that brings you to a main hub. It is bizarre that we've gone through so much economic growth and we're, you know, first world country with all the problems that come with that, and we still haven't brought that piece of infrastructure.
And my constituents want the metro built, and what they hear when Jim says, well, don't put it here and don't put it there and don't put it somewhere else, what they hear is just another delay. And to be fair to them, they have had nothing but delays. It is now time for them to get their metro.
I don't know how many times I can say it, I'm in favour of the metro. The vast majority of people who appeared before the oral hearing were in favour. Some people thought it was a bad idea because of the cost of it. I think it's a good idea. I think we do need rail infrastructure link between Swords and the city centre. I'm just saying we're entitled to put forward a proposal that maybe where they're suggesting it should terminate is the wrong location. And if you look at what happened with Metro North, when On Board Panola looked at that before, back in 2009, it determined that the appropriate location for it to terminate was in the city centre in Stephen's Green.
Yeah, but that's real constituency politics, isn't it? You don't want the disruption. You don't want people disembarking and getting on.
Sorry. The reason I'm advocating it is I think we would be much more beneficial for this city if we had a rail link that head southwest, if we had a metro that went southwest from the city centre. If you terminate in Charlemont, that won't happen.
He's selflessly thinking of other constituencies.
I think it just shows all politics is local. You know, we do need a metro. We should have had one decades ago. Dublin's a European capital, the economic hub of Ireland, and it needs an effective transport system. And a metro that would connect, as you say, Philip, Dublin city centre to the airport, to the biggest airport in the country, not only the airport, but also to the suburbs. You know, it's an exciting prospect. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, it's one with no pain, no gain. There will be disruption. There will be destruction, but it is for the greater good. And we had the final day of the
and endless oil debates hearings about its cost.
I just got a text literally from a constituent there, and she said it's 33 years that we are waiting for it. So, I mean, I think the time for, and there may well be debates about it, but this is a project that is so vitally needed for Swords and for Dublin Airport. I mean, the time has to be now to get it.
Listen, I don't want to rain on anyone's Easter parade, but motorists are going to wake up on Monday morning with that Sunday night feeling, perhaps going into the week with a petrol and diesel hike on the agenda, because excise is being restored. There's another 4 cent, I think, going on to petrol, and then diesel will be 3 cent. And there are those, we had Pierce Doherty, Louise, on the programme during the week, saying that absolutely should not happen. Jim, your view on this?
Well, listen, excise rates were cut when fuel rates were particularly high. I remember when they nearly got to 200 cent per litre. But
this will take them over 180.
I know. But it's like, if you look at the station, say it's about 177, I think, in terms of a litre. We cut excise at a time when numbers were really high. I don't think it's tenable for us now to say we'll just keep postponing that. It was a short-term measure to deal with the cost of living crisis. I think Minister McGrath is correct in terms of, we said we'd do it for a period of time and gradually it's going back up. So listen, we're losing money for the state in order to provide for services if we just keep the excise at a very low rate. So I think there was an arrangement entered into. It was a fair one at the time, but I think the only coherent response of government is to allow it go back as had been planned.
And you want to delay it altogether until when?
What Jim said there is quite instructive. It was a short-term measure intended to address the cost of living. Now, I'm sure that Jim wouldn't have enough of a brass neck to say that the cost of living crisis is over. It's not. It's still being felt in homes. And as Pierce Doherty has said on more than one occasion on the floor of the Dáil, and I think on your programme yesterday, Claire, this is an issue that should be kept under constant review. And the simple fact is that people cannot afford these increases again. And remember, this is the first of three increases that's going to be put in place this year. Mm-hmm. And people simply cannot afford it. If it was a short-term measure intended to address the cost of living crisis, well, then I don't think Jim is saying that that the cost of living crisis is over. It's not. People are still feeling it. I spoke to a woman yesterday who's still paying off her ESB bill, not from last winter, but from the winter before. So the cost of living crisis is very real and heaping. And we've just literally had a conversation here about how people can't access public transport. They have no choice but to use their car. So these are the people, and perhaps they're not in Jim's constituency, because they're hopping on and off the Dart and the Lewis and everything else, and good luck to them. But they are in my constituency. They have no choice but to get into their car. And all they hear from the government, a tone-deaf government, is that you're going to have to pay more now to drive your car. And by the way, you know, you might get your metro at some point. But I mean, it's just very, very unfair.
All right, well, we move on to, I want to talk about the guards, because Simon Harris, when he was confirmed as Fine Gael leader last weekend, he made a big play, didn't he, about law and order and supporting the Gardaí. The government, though, is struggling to hit its current recruitment target of 15,000. Now we have the Association of Garda Sergeants and Inspectors saying that we actually need 18,000, Philip. Is that a realistic total to try and aim for when 15,000 is out of reach?
Well, I think so. It comes down to immigration again. Our population is soaring, so we need to have a police force that matches that and grows along with it. The unfortunate thing is that being a guard is not a very attractive career anymore for a lot of people, for a couple of reasons. One is just society has changed over years, and maybe the Gard isn't seen, given the respect that they probably deserve in communities around the country, when they would have been there alongside the doctor, the priest, the publican, and if that's the right group of people to pitch them in with. But and the other side of it is, well, rightly or wrongly, the disciplinary proceedings within the force these days are putting a lot of people off and pushing a lot of people out as well who are in there.
Well, the perception of them.
The perception of them is, yeah. So like it is, it's a double-edged sword that way, that it's really hard to attract people into them when there's that lack of confidence in what the career might be and how it might end up.
Mary, do you think that's a realistic target, 18,000?
Well, the AGSI is arguing that the pace of retirements and resignations is outstripping the number of new members, and they've been very vocal about what they believe is motivating those retirements and resignations, i.e. it's not just age related, it's also morale related.
People opting to get out.
Some good things have happened, and a key thing I think to watch will be the outcome of the decision to raise the limit for the application to the Garda from 35 to 50. You know, there's so many fit and healthy people in their 40s who I think would like to contribute something practical to the public service. And there was a big surge in applications then to join the Garda last year's recruitment drive when more than 6,000 applied. You know, you could argue that was a once off with the news of that being in the media. Yeah, but let's see, you know, and I think it'd be good that different types of people will apply to the Garda and make for a more diverse force, with people coming from a greater variety of backgrounds and, you know, applying with the assorted skills that they bring, they've learned elsewhere. But I suppose just on a more somber note, it's hard to ignore the warnings from road safety campaigners. And I think, you know, the whole country is in despair, really, at the amount of terrible road incidents we've had on the roads so far this year, and not yet Easter. And, you know, those campaigners are expressing concern that reduced numbers of Gardaí policing the roads will have an impact. Now, the Garda have put out a statement saying there's no organisation policy to reduce numbers assigned to road policing units, but like it is definitely one to watch and one that a lot of people are concerned about.
It's hard to see, even with the best will in the world, how you would get to 18,000. Do you think it's the right figure, Jim?
Well, I think we don't have enough Gardaí. At present, we have 14,000 members of the force. That's the same as we had back in 2008, which is 16 years ago, and our population's probably increased by 800,000 since then. Like, the government has made money available to recruit 1,000 new Gardaí every year. The problem is we've been having difficulty recruiting them. Like, I had advocated a number of proposals which have been implemented now about raising the recruitment age, raising the retirement age, and hopefully they will have an impact. But this is something that we're going to have to keep under constant review. I don't think we have enough at 14,000 or 15,000. I would like to see us to get to a situation of having 18,000 Gardaí. And also, when you think of all the new laws that are being developed, like, it's not just the increase of the population, it's the increase of the laws. And every time we make a new criminal offence, the Gardaí have greater amount of work to do. So there needs to be a recognition. We need to keep looking at the recruitment issue. We need to try to get more members into the force. And we need to start promoting it as a job, that it's a positive job. And we need to start respecting the Gardaí more.
Maybe it's not a uniformed, you know, an increase in above 15,000 of uniformed Gardaí, but more civilian backup.
Yeah, we've a lot of civilian backup. There has been civilianisation of the force. Like, ultimately what people want to see, and it's a great thing in Ireland, people want to see more Gardaí on the street. Like, in other countries, they don't want police officers coming into their area. The great thing about Ireland is you go to public meetings, people want to see more Gardaí. And, like, we need to ensure, and so this is the Commissioner's task, to get more Gardaí out in the beat. But in order for that to happen effectively, yeah, we need more civilianisation, but also we need to recruit more.
Louise?
Yeah, I think what's the thing that I, when you talk to Gardaí, will tell you this, the thing that's troubling them are the resignations. That people who have started to work on Garda Síochána, and I note that at the AGSI conference, they referenced the housing crisis. I've had Gardaí in my constituency clinics who were faced with eviction, could not find anywhere to live, absolutely petrified at the thought of having to go into emergency accommodation for all sorts of reasons that I'm sure we can all understand. But the housing crisis, and, you know, it is the one thing, by the way, that the new leader of Fine Gael has very deftly tried to avoid saying anything about at all.
And he hasn't, I suppose he hasn't said much at all, really, because he's not Taoiseach yet. There's a bit of a lacuna there.
It is a very serious issue, and I think people would like to hear his thoughts on it.
I just think for morale, if we were talking about that in the force as well, it wouldn't have helped morale in the force that after the Dublin riots that Sinn Féin came straight out and essentially blamed the guards for the riots. Like,
That's not true, though, Philip.
But he was straight out calling for the Garda commissioner to resign, and that's focusing the blame of the riots on the Garda for not managing it.
There's a world of difference between the leadership of An Garda Síochána
but that's exactly
and the Garda on the beat.
And you wouldn't have a lot of Garda on the beat on a weekly basis if you came out and heard that straight. If you're a guard on the street, you face being kicked around by little scrotes who are shoplifting shops. And the leader of the opposition and the Taoiseach in waiting comes out and blames the guards for what happened.
And that's crazy. And, you know, to be fair now, I think you know that that's not the case.
That's exactly what happened.
And that is not what happened. In the immediate aftermath, actually, what we did was we highlighted the fact that the Gardaí were left without leadership. And if you talk to Gardaí, ordinary Gardaí on the beat, they will tell you exactly that, that they felt that they were left without leadership. That is what was said. And it was important to say that. But the number of resignations from An Garda Síochána points to the fact that it is not an attractive job, that people go into the job with the best will in the world. It is not an attractive job. And part of that is because they don't have sufficient numbers. So there does need to be an increase in recruitment. There does need to be an increase in the number of men and women in the Garda Reserve as well to support members of An Garda Síochána. Because that's the one thing. When you talk to retailers, and you mentioned shoplifting there, when you talk to retailers, when you talk to people working in retail and people who own retail businesses, okay, they will tell you
part of the problem is it is a very attractive recruit to take on a member of An Garda Síochána. If you work in the private sector, you can recruit a guard from the age of 50 onwards or even below that. So there's many more options out there for members of An Garda Síochána, and that's part of the problem.
Okay.
They're so well trained that they're wanted elsewhere.
We have to leave it there. Thank you all for coming in and have a lovely Easter, and the same goes for you listening at home. Hope you have a lovely weekend. We'll be back with you here on Tuesday. Marty Morrissey will be here on Monday morning. The programme today was produced by Rachel Graham. The series producer is Niamh Lines. Our researcher today, Amy Ryan. Jarlath Holland was our broadcast coordinator, and James Feeney was on sound. Let's head over to Louise.